Rica, so the Captain can marry us on board, and then we'll step off for probably a week or so in Costa Rica. That's where Gianna spent the last 6 years, so looking forward to a really good honeymoon, if I may, though, because we are going around the world on a cruise ship.
And never-ending honeymoon. Amazing.
There you
just got to fix up your sister now, Angela. There's still time.
Thank you both.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Oh, I found that all quite overwhelming.
Yeah, beautiful.
If I'm honest. Right, let's get back to the news, shall we? Reluctantly, but here we go. Sir Keir Starmer will speak at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool later and will call on people to join a shared struggle to build a new Britain. The Prime Minister will admit there are no easy answers, but that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Pat McFadden, the Minister for the Cabinet Office, told us the government has to take tough decisions, such as cutting the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners.
Getting the public finances sorted is an inescapable duty of government. You just can't run away from it. And we know what happened when people tried to run away from it in the past. Everybody suffers when that happens. We will protect the value of the basic state pension through the triple lock. We will get the public finances sorted.
Israel says it's carried out more strikes on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon as thousands of people flee north to escape the fighting. The Lebanese health ministry says nearly 500 people were killed by a wave of Israeli attacks yesterday. The Israeli military says it hit around 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon says most of the sites were residential.
A former chief executive of Harrods has told the BBC he witnessed abhorrent behaviour by the former owner, Mohammed Fayed. James MacArthur, who ran the department store for 10 months in 2008, denied being aware of any sexual abuse. Dozens of women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by Fayed, who died last year.
The number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police forces rose significantly in the last year. 27 of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association. More than 900 illegal e-bikes were seized, compared to 511 for the previous 12 months. Sergeant Stuart Ford leads the City of London Police Cycle Response Unit.
What they'll do is they'll go and buy a kit online with a throttle and a lithium battery, or sometimes two lithium batteries, and then a rear motor that fits on the rear wheel. And what they're doing, by just holding the throttle open, these types of bikes will go up to sort of 30, 40 miles an hour quite easily. What they've done is they've actually turned it into a moped, which you need insurance for, which is how we are seizing them off of them. We're seizing them because they've got no insurance.
And the former BBC radio and TV presenter Chris Searle, best known for appearing on That's Life, has died at the age of 81. Dame Esther Anson described him as funny, clever and charming. And we were saying earlier, just a man with a very kind face and sort of kind attitude, very warm presenter. Mm. And talking of wholesome TV, we were talking Bake Off earlier.
Yep.
You were saying how much you loved My Mum, Your Dad.
My Mum, Your Dad, brilliant show.
Maria from My Mum, Your Dad has texted us.
Wow. Morning,
say,
Maria.
I love listening to you guys in the morning. So pleased you're enjoying the series.
Oh, come on.
I'm excited for you.
She is great. She's absolutely fantastic. And it's so heartwarming. And Maria, you've been so honest on this programme, which I think is that's what I watch it. And I think it doesn't actually matter whether anybody gets together or anybody buys a hat. It's just a conversation between people in midlife who've been through relationships, are out the other side and are navigating that sort of choppy waters of how you date again and loneliness. And they're talking about all of this. And it's just so refreshing that people are talking about stuff like that, that is seen sort of come with shame. But they kind of go, it's not shameful. It's just life. It's brilliant. You're brilliant, Maria.
Important conversations to have.
Yeah.
Are Manchester City being open and honest about what's happening with Rodri, Katie?
Well, we've got a latest update this morning now. This is on midfielder Rodri, who was injured during that 2-2 draw against Arsenal at the weekend. He's going to have further tests on the knee injury that looks set to rule him out for an extended period of time. So he travelled to Spain for initial tests yesterday, and sources have told the BBC that further tests are required to discover the exact extent of the problem. Just to mark your cards, City are actually in action already again this evening. They host Watford in the League Cup third round later. Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club. It's subject to approval. And leg spinner Adil Rashid says he has no plans to retire any anytime soon. It's as England attempt to rebuild their white ball sides. He and Jofra Archer are the only survivors from the 2019 World Cup winning squad in the current group taking on Australia. That's in a 5-match ODI series today. Is now must win for England at Chesler Street. Commentary on Sports Extra from 12:15.
After our chat with Angela and Jean, who got engaged on that cruise ship that's still docked in Belfast, DJ Cheshire says this: "Hi Claire, Rachel, and there is the title of the 2-part miniseries, Everything Happens in Belfast."
Absolutely, yeah. A made-for-TV series waiting for happen film series.
Let's be ambitious, big screen. Go and see that. I love Belfast. Matt's here with the weather. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Claire. Morning, all. Well, as Ona will tell, there's still some residual impact from the rain yesterday, but overall, England, Wales, a drier day. Patchy rain or drizzle, extensive cloud at the moment, gradually easing through, brightening up into the afternoon, sunny spells, just the odd shower. Northern Ireland, sunshine and showers today. Showers mainly in the north and west. Some in the south and east will stay dry. A bit more sunshine this afternoon than so far today. And across Scotland, outbreaks of rain in the north. They're going to work their way southwards into southern areas by the end of the afternoon. There will be some in Orkney, Shetland, also in Dumfries and Galloway, who could stay completely dry. Cool across the north, 10 to 14. In the south, 13 to 18 degrees.
How about the roads, Orna?
Yes, residual problems with the flooding, including the A5 in Milton Keynes. Quite a big stretch of it at the Portwood roundabout in particular, though. The M8, if you're heading towards Edinburgh, eastbound Junction 3 at Livingston, an accident happened. It's left long delays. 50 minutes it's taking from the back of the queue at Junction 5 Shotts. M60 clockwise still queuing over Barton Bridge after an accident, which is in one of the lanes. Leaves back to 10 at the Trafford Centre clockwise. M40 southbound a breakdown, Junction 3 at Loudwater, one lane down. Heavy traffic on the M25, broken down van near the M4 at Junction 15, M25 clockwise at 15, and the M23, another breakdown, 9 at Gatwick Airport, one lane down, heading towards the M25 if you're heading north, or a merchant to 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Morning, everyone. Tuesday morning, it is 5 Live Breakfast with Claire and Rachel this morning. Let's bring you up to date on what we've been talking about in the programme so far, some of the bits you've missed. We're looking ahead to the Prime Minister's speech to the Labour Party conference later today. Do, by the way, keep your texts coming in on questions for Keir Starmer. We're hoping to get some time with him this afternoon and we'll bring you that interview tomorrow if it goes ahead.
Earlier, I spoke to Labour's Minister for the Cabinet Office, Pat McFadden, about how the government is settling public sector pay deals.
We will always try and do right by the NHS workforce. But like everything else, when you're making a decision about spending in one area, in this case pay, then you have to take into account public spending in the round.
We've also been talking about e-bikes today, but also looking at why there's been this big rise in the number of illegally modified e-bikes being seized by police.
These types of bikes will go up to sort of 30, 40 miles an hour quite easily. And what they've done is they've actually turned it into a moped, which you need insurance for.
And we've been talking about boring places. This after Hatfield in Hertfordshire was found to be the most boring town in the UK. Well, Mike was having none of it. We got him on earlier to stick up for Hatfield.
There's a lot of very passionate people in this town and do a lot of good deeds just for the good of the town. And to find ourselves at the top of this boring list is proper wrong, I think.
Mike was terrific when
he was
spoke
great.
To him earlier.
So many facts that weren't boring.
No. Keep your texts coming in on boring facts about where you live. Texts like this: boring facts about your town. Letchworth Garden City has the first roundabout built on a road in the UK. Thank you for that. 85058. Go on.
Potsy says, Sunderland, many interesting things, so I'm struggling, but how about the electric light bulb was invented, Joseph Swan, and the first aluminium bascule bridge. I mean,
that's verging on exciting.
It is actually. Mm. That's a kind of historical fact, but it depends how you tell it, I suppose, Potsy. Thank you.
Right, let's start with this then. The Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, making his first party conference speech as Prime Minister. That's today, this afternoon. I think you'll hear it on, well, I know you'll hear it on 5 Live. I think it's at 2 o'clock, so it'll be in Matt Chorley's show. He is expected to say that tough decisions need to be taken in order to build a new Britain. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, told us what to expect.
Tough choices, tough times to come, in Keir Starmer's words from this speech, a shared struggle. But that there is light at the end of that tunnel, that eventually those tough choices will pay a dividend. Now, that is more of the same when it comes to yesterday, and we heard that from Rachel Reeves. But before that, there was a lot of grumbling in the senior ranks of this government that it was all too much doom and gloom and not enough. Well, here's what you get from putting up with the doom and gloom. So what you've really got coming into view, I think, over the course of today and yesterday is a government which thinks it perhaps slightly oversteered on the doom and gloom, slightly oversteered on the messaging about how tough things would be, and now wants to do more of the other side of the equation and tell people why things might have to be tough for a bit for an ultimate prize.
Well, let's speak to a couple of Labour activists. Jenny Young has been at the conference this week, and Cathy Bowle from Disability Labour. That's a group affiliated to the Labour Party. Morning, Jenny. Morning, Cathy.
Morning.
Morning.
Lovely to talk to both of you. Are you both still in Liverpool at the moment?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So I came home last night, but I was there the last couple of days.
Okay. And is that Jenny who's just got home, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Right. Tell us how your experience has been so far then. Let's start with you, Jenny, and then we'll come to Cathy.
It's been fantastic. I mean, it's just such a difference. So I was at the conference last year where we were opposition, and the difference when you're in government, you know, the things that Angela Rayner and Rachel Reeves are announcing in their speech are things that we are actually going to get on and do in government. And there is, you know, beside the messaging about the doom and gloom from the media and things, there is a real buzz around the conference of celebrating an election victory.
Just to say, the doom and gloom hasn't really come from the media. The doom and gloom has come from the Prime Minister and the Chancellor themselves. They were very clear the sort of tone they were setting as soon as they came into power. So that's something that I think they're trying to adjust now.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said about being grown up and honest about the challenges facing the country. You know, we've had 14 years of chaos, incompetence, and, you know, that can't be fixed overnight. So I think people, it's good to be honest. But yeah, I think, like you said in your introduction, saying there are tough choices to make just now, but the prize is economic growth, it's an NHS that actually works, it's trains that actually run on time, it's all these things that people actually want government to deliver, but it takes hard work and tough decisions right now to get there.
But you're feeling relatively upbeat, are you?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It's been good.
Cathy, are you upbeat?
Yes. No.
Oh.
Well, I mean, I have to say I'd rather be under a Labour government than any other variety. Mm-hmm. But from the disability community, the first big policy announcement was one fuel payment thing. And that's really made people think about whether or not they want to be in the Labour Party, whether the Labour Party will actually deliver. And, you know, it's great if, I mean, I know Rachel Reeves has said it a couple times, being the party of the working person, but what about the people who can't work? And there's plenty of us. In fact, there's plenty of us who were working when COVID came out and can't work now. And there's has been no discussion about the lives of the people who lost their lives during COVID and during all through austerity.
In fact, quite the opposite, because, well, if the front page of the Times is to be believed this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is going to be taking aim at people who are economically inactive, but who are potentially also taking money from the benefit system when they could be working. So that is the line that he may well be going down. Just on the winter fuel payments, it's worth saying Pat mm-hmm. McFadden on this programme earlier doubled down on that once again and said, look, we knew we'd have to take tough decisions. And this is one of those difficult decisions that was inevitable given the state of the public finances. But do you think they really fully understood that the damage that this would do as one of their first decisions when they came to power?
No, I don't think they knew, and they don't know because they're not talking to us. I have not had a conversation, not that I'm the be-all and end-all, but I'm here, I'm listening, I can tell you what disabled people are saying, and it's not all brightness. I mean, the people who suffered the worst through the Tory austerity are mostly disabled people. And you have people sitting in the cold. The only warmth they get is if they go to a warm space. Now we have no more COVID. Where are those spaces going to be where they can actually get warm? And once you're warm, going back to a home that's cold isn't going to help you. And a lot of people who are disabled also have the need to have higher temperatures in their homes because they're affected worse.
Jenny, without spending too long on winter fuel payments, because we have talked a lot about it, but do you think that there is a slight sense the Labour leadership is out of touch with its membership, that this was a misstep amongst other missteps? And when you add to it the freebies that they've got, the clothing they've had pay for it, it really leaves a lot of activists with an uncomfortable feeling.
I mean, I think those are two separate things, the freebies and the winter fuel payment, to be honest. I think, I would just briefly say on the freebies, I think the standard to which we hold the Labour government is far, far higher than the frankly abysmal standard that the Tories even failed to reach. So that's what I would say on that. On the winter fuel payment, I mean, I think Pat McFadden was quite right. Like, it is a difficult decision. I don't think anyone feels that it has been easy, and perhaps the kind of the messaging and the communication could have been better. But to just go on doing all the things that that were happening before just isn't feasible. I would also say there are plenty of other people, young people, working people who are not getting any support with their fuel bills. So yes, it's not been an easy decision, and I don't think it's a decision that was taken lightly. But when they talk about difficult decisions, this is the sort of thing they talk about. And actually, I think there's something to be said for having the courage of your convictions that for the long-term good, this is something that needs to be done, rather than what we had for 14 years, which was a government that frankly didn't have the courage of its convictions and would sort of U-turn left, right and centre.
Okay.
So it's not easy, but it's perhaps needed for the long term.
Well, both your views on that are clear. So let's park that one for now and just look ahead to what the Prime Minister might say later today. What specifically are you looking for from him? Jenny first.
I think we saw it a bit in certainly in Angela Rayner's speech on Sunday, and I was in the hall for the Chancellor's speech yesterday as well. A bit more about what's the prize on offer? What is it that we're wanting to achieve? Yes, there are the difficult decisions, but I think setting out, you know, what is our vision for Britain? This, they've talked about a decade of national renewal. Well, what's that going to look like? What's it going to mean? What are the things? And then I think that makes the sacrifices of the sort of hard decisions now somewhat not easier, but you know, you can see what we are aiming for.
Are there any specific policy announcements you'd like that will help them achieve that in your view?
I don't know. I mean, I think I'm not the person to,
because we always hear a lot of aspiration, we always hear a vision, don't we, for the future, but we don't always get much detail on how they're going to get there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've had announcements already. So Angela Rayner made announcements on planning and house building. Rachel Reeves had an announcement about breakfast clubs for children in schools and that pilot starting before the sort of national rollout. So that's something that makes a difference in terms of, you know, it's hard. I used to be a teacher. It's hard for children to learn if they're hungry. So that's something that is a sort of a concrete thing that the government is going to do to reduce child poverty and improve outcomes for people across the country.
Okay, well, we'll wait to hear what he has to say later. Jenny, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Jenny. Oh, we have managed to get Cathy back because her line dropped. Cathy, can you hear me okay?
Yep, I can hear you.
Terrific. Fine. Yeah, so if you just tell us, what would you like to hear specifically from the Prime Minister this afternoon?
Well, I would like to hear from the Prime Minister that he would agree, and his top team would agree, to meet with not only disability labour, but disability led groups to talk about the kinds of things that we know we could get the government to save money on, which wouldn't leave disabled people, elderly people, those who are on lower incomes, out in the cold. I would rather have them doing things and be able to trust them, but the trust has been damaged by previous governments, and we're looking for hope. Just a bit of hope, acknowledgement that we exist, and some of us can't work. Mm-hmm. Some of us would love to work, but it's just not possible with the some of the illnesses and disabilities that we have.
Well, thank you so much, Cathy, for putting those points forward. We'll enjoy the rest of the conference and the Prime Minister's speech this afternoon. Thanks for your time. I think that's Cathy Bowle from Disability Labour. Jenny Young, you also heard, who was a Labour activist who was there but has since travelled home. And you're sending in your questions for Keir Starmer. As I mentioned, we're hoping to speak to him this afternoon. These things are always a bit subject to change, but hopefully we'll be able to bring you that interview tomorrow. So if you have any questions for the PM that you'd like us to put to him, please do text us 85058. It's 19 minutes past 8.
On BBC iPlayer.
I want to take you on tour. I want to take you to India.
Wow! Buzzing, mate.
I've never been anywhere like it.
Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams on tour.
We represented England, but we represented something far bigger than that. We represented Preston.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Five Live Breakfast, Rachel and Claire with you today. Good to have your company. Now, there is a busy night ahead of League Cup third round action on Five Live Sport. We'll have full commentary of Aston Villa's trip to League One, Wycombe Wanderers. We'll also bring you updates of Manchester City against Watford, League Two Walsall against Leicester City, and an intriguing game at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea host League Two Barrow. Here's Barrow's head coach, Stephen Clements.
We're talking about proper world-class footballers here, and we're under no illusions, it will be difficult. But saying that, we're going into a game of football, it's 11v11, anything can happen. And obviously, if you can get through 90 minutes, there's a penalty shootout, there's no extra time, you just never know in this game. So we'll go there and we'll give it our best shot.
Fighting talk. Let's speak to Barrow's sporting director, Ian Wood. Morning, Ian.
Good morning.
Oh, what are you, nervous, excited, exhilarated?
I'm a little bit of both, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit nervous, sort of. It's a massive game. We're on a good run at the moment, and we're going down to a place that could give us a bit of a shock today, but hopefully that we put a good performance in.
I'm sure you will, because let's talk about that. You're joint top of League Two after your first seven games. I mean, you must be delighted with how the season started.
Yeah, for sure. The season's only just started, really. It's seven games in, and, you know, we've got to continue that trajectory of what we're doing at this moment in time. But it is a long season, and the boys are doing tremendous. So, yeah, it's a good start.
And it seems a bit odd to even say this, but with that in mind, is this Chelsea game a bit of a distraction or a welcome run at a cup competition?
It's hard to say, because I think you would turn around and say that a lot of people would say, If we win a Chelsea tonight, didn't really get a good result, as it could derail us a little bit. But it's still, as I said earlier, it's a bit early in the season. We're just looking forward to it tonight, that's all.
Yeah, as Billie Jean King would say, pressure is a privilege. So the more you have it, the more you have it, the better you get. Tell us about your group of players. Head coach Stephen Clements, we heard there. You know, he's really made an impact, and it seems a really great bunch there, good culture. Midfielder Sam Foley says the dressing room culture at the club is behind your strong start to the season.
Yeah, I think that's, it's a saying, I think if you bottle it up and you could sell it, that's sort of the atmosphere that we have within the football club at the moment. And since I've been at the football club, it has been that, and that's built from the head coach, it's built from the players, it's built from the word is belief as well. It's having belief that you're good enough to be where you are. And just because, you know, we're Barrow doesn't mean that we can't be at the top of the league. And we try to push that into the players. I try to push that into the staff. And it seems to be working.
I'm really interested because there's a really interesting article on the BBC Sport website. And Sam Foley says this. He says, the culture at the football club is slightly different to a lot of clubs in the EFL. The lads buy into that and fully accept who they are. That gives us the upper hand to be able to go places, stick our chest out and say, we know what we are. We know what we can bring. What is it then? What is that sort of magic ingredient?
I think it's just belief. Mm. So I think it is belief to turn around and just say, just because we are Barrow, you know, we can compete with the bigger teams in the league. And I think that's starting, the tide's starting to turn a little bit, where people are turning around saying, look, you know, Barrow's not a rollover. You know, you've got to turn up. And that's credit to the staff, to the players. And it is just the belief of... We put events on the other day. We did team bonding. We went to the Cube. They played darts. We do
What's
stuff
the cube?
Off the field.
What's the Cube?
The Cube on ITV, actually, where it's a game show and you play games and it's team bonding and you have to beat things. And yeah, it's just sort of putting those sort of things into the players where they're getting closer and, yeah, team bonding and belief.
Yeah, and day trips. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. That's you've got to come up, you've got to keep them interested. That's the, yeah. You've got to keep them interested. You've got to come up with new ideas and you've got to, you just got to keep on giving them new tasks to start thinking, because it can come mundane. It can, yeah. Every single day training, getting up at the same time, sort of sessions, another game, away from their family, this, that, and the other. So yeah, it's putting different things on for them as well to keep them interested.
I was going to ask you, which Chelsea players are you most concerned about? But maybe I should be asking, which Barrow players should Chelsea be concerned about? But maybe answer a little bit of both.
Yeah, Chelsea might try and get some of them on loan. You never know, they might want some games. And no,
don't joke.
But from our point of view, I mean, we did our analyst stuff yesterday. The names on the board we just looked at and just went, right, well, what are we going to do here, kind of thing. So, you know, whoever they put out is going to be an unbelievable team. The lads are just looking forward to it. And, you know, we're just going to give it a good shot and see where it takes us, really.
You know what you've got, Ian, that they don't have? The Barrow belief.
That's exactly
that. I'm a believer.
Let's see what happens. Yeah. Let's see what happens.
Great to talk to you. Thanks for giving us your time.
No, you're welcome. Nice to speak to you.
Ian Wood there, Barrow Sporting Director, and Five Live Sport will have full commentary of Aston Villa's trip to League One, Wycombe Wanderers. We'll also bring you updates of Walsall v Leicester City, Man City against Watford, and of course, the aforementioned Chelsea against Barrow, 8:25.
Just a few texts in response to our In My Opinion today, which came from a teacher, secondary school teacher, who says that the way that we set homework for children needs to change. She says there's great value in it, but it needs to be shorter, 15 minutes max. It needs to be targeted at individual children rather than a sort of blanket sheet of work for everyone. And it needs to be very specific in the way that it gets you to recall information. All of which, of course, sounds like it's much more time consuming potentially for teachers to set. So loads of you giving your response to this this morning. In regards to homework, says this one, I think the teacher you had on is working in a school from the last century. Most secondary schools now pay subscription for homework software for subjects that set the work online automatically every week in line with their scheme of work. This also marks the work, uses algorithms to bespoke the work level over time according to the speed and ability of students completing the work, then sends the data weekly to the teacher. The teacher does nothing other than review the data. I'm a secondary maths teacher. Life has never been so easy. Teachers like to moan, but most have never actually left school, so have no real awareness of industry and what actual work is. That's Adam in Birmingham's view.
Yeah, Matthew says this. I was a head teacher, secondary, for 16 years. Homework is one of the things that increases the gap between disadvantaged and non-disadvantaged students. The less advantaged students in general have less support at home, so the gap between them and their more advantaged peers gets bigger. Get rid of homework, says Matthew.
And just finally, this one, Morning 5 Live. Here is how my 13-year-old son described his English homework in his planner. I'm not entirely sure that's how his teacher described it, and they've WhatsApped us a picture in his homework planner, and it just says, in actually very neat handwriting, for English, lose your sanity on a reading website. So fair enough. Right, 850-58 for any more of those. Now, another big story that's been developing in the last few days, Israeli airstrikes on Hezbollah, which have continued overnight. Thousands of people fleeing their homes in southern Lebanon to escape the fighting there.
Zahra Swali is a 20-year-old student who lived in a village on the border with Israel, but moved to another part of Lebanon earlier this year. She's been speaking about the current situation.
We don't feel safe, obviously, but this is our land. We can't just abandon our land. Where are we supposed to go? You know, a lot of people are still stuck on the streets. Some streets were bombed, I heard. And a lot of my friends are still stuck since morning. They are still stuck in traffic because a lot of people are trying to flee. It caused a huge, huge traffic jam.
Well, the Israeli military says it hit around 1,600 targets. Hezbollah has this morning claimed to have launched rockets at military bases in Israel. Dr. Stephen Wagner is a senior lecturer in international security at Brunel University of London. Morning.
Good morning.
Can you see this heading in any direction other than all-out war?
I'm actually not sure. Well, it depends what we mean by all-out war. If we're talking about ground maneuvers by either side, I actually think the risk is still, it's elevated, but it's still an unlikely outcome. We're in a weird situation where both sides are using barrage means, you know, the Israeli Air Force on the one hand and Hezbollah's rocket force on the other. that were intended for other purposes. So Israel's bombing campaign and the pager attack, for example, clearly been long planned, and but seemed to me to be intended to open up a ground maneuver, which the IDF is not actually capable of doing in the near term. So they're just trying to instead use this as a pressure tactic to get Hezbollah to retreat from the border, whereas Hezbollah has been sitting on this large rocket force. They regard it as a deterrent, maybe something to use is the opening of like their own ground raid on Israel, like the, you know, what Hamas had done back in October. But that chance has passed. So we're in this strange standoff. And from my point of view, the ball is in Hezbollah's court. Mm. They have to decide how they're going to proceed.
But you look at the damage that's been caused. Nearly 500 mm-hmm. people killed in a single day yesterday, including 35 mm-hmm. children. This is having devastating consequences.
Indeed.
Is it not the case that Israel will have to make a call on whether it feels it's diminished Hezbollah's capabilities enough to protect people in northern Israel?
Well, that will be both a security decision and a political decision. And the latter point is the problem in Israel, where you have a leader whose self-interest requires prolonging this war. And that's not just me saying that, like senior staff in the army have said that, you know. So we are in an unfortunate situation where I'm not sure the Israeli campaign is actually very likely to succeed at restoring people to their homes and restoring calm to the northern border. Mm. Hezbollah, as long as they don't use their whole rocket force, they maintain that kind of threat over the north, and they maintain that leverage.
And they say they're going to continue those bombardments until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. But with Israel so focused on this particular military direction at the moment, what kind of energy is being put into those peace talks, if any?
Well, that's the open question. There seems to be no political will on Israel's part, and certainly not on Hamas's part either. Hamas, like Hezbollah, realize that all they need to do is dig in and endure this this campaign, and it will be up to Israel to change its policy or decide to continue this grind in all the consequences that come with it. Grim as that might sound, that's the situation.
And just briefly, there is a UN meeting coming up, isn't there? Can the UN offer any kind of influence at all in a situation like this?
So maybe. So the General Assembly is opening now. In fact, it's an open question whether the Israeli Prime Minister even travels at this stage. My view is that the best bet for a kind of international intervention would be one which tries to enforce the UN Security Council Resolution 1701, passed in 2006, which ended the last Hezbollah war with Israel. That would see Hezbollah retreat north of the Tani River, and only the Lebanese army occupying the strip between the river and the Israeli border. That would satisfy Israeli demands and certainly remove the pretext for this war from their part. But we're talking about a Security Council resolution where the P5 are at one another's throats at the moment. So I'm not sure this is very likely. But if they can find common ground, there is, at least on this issue, it's possible, if not likely.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stephen Wagner, who's a senior lecturer in international security at Brunel University. 8:33, and Nikki's here from 9 o'clock this morning. What you got, Nikki?
Hello, I'll tell you. February 2023, the Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said in a speech, antisocial behaviour in town centres is corroding the local and economic fabric. Today, Shadow no more, she will be making a speech and she will say rising street crime is corroding the fabric of our communities. Corroding, a chosen word. Is it a well-chosen word? We want to get out there in amongst it. Tell us, does it resonate with you where you are? Is this another day, another Home Secretary talking tough, chasing the headlines, the Daily Mail Holy Grail, or a new Home Secretary getting tough, chasing down the yobs, sorting out local communities, making streets safer? We said goodbye to Asbos way back. She wants to bring in respect orders. And you know what we're talking about here. You live amongst it. Shoplifting, off-road bikes, harassment, intimidating behaviour, drug use, littering, street drinking. Police are going to have new powers to scrap dirt and quad bikes. Hit squads to target knife point robberies. They want mobile phone companies to put in a kill switch on new phones to stop them being stolen. But what is actually happening where you live? Tell us about that corrosion. What does antisocial behaviour look like near you? What would help fix it, make life better? We want to hear from our listeners all over the country to get a picture what life's like around the UK. Politicians, listen to this phone-in, this programme right now. They'll be listening to you. Is antisocial behaviour corroding your community? Antisocial behaviour and you at 9 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Message on WhatsApp 08085 909693. Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms for our terms of use and privacy notice. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And here are the news headlines just after 8:30. Israel says it's continued to attack Hezbollah targets in Lebanon overnight. The Lebanese health ministry says nearly 500 people were killed yesterday in what it called indiscriminate airstrikes. Thousands of people have been fleeing southern Lebanon.
Sir Keir Starmer makes his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister later and will warn of a shared struggle ahead, but promises there is light at the end of the tunnel. Sir Keir will tell the conference in Liverpool that tough decisions need to be taken to build a new Britain.
A former chief executive of Harrods has told the BBC he witnessed abhorrent behaviour by the former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. But James MacArthur, who was in charge for 10 months in 2008, says he was not aware of any sexual abuse.
And there's been a big rise in the number of illegally modified electric bikes being confiscated by police. Figures show at least 900 illegal e-bikes were seized in the last year. That's up from 511 in the previous 12 months.
Let's get the weather now. Here's Matt. Morning again, Matt.
Morning again, Claire. Not a bad day today for England and Wales after the heavy rain of yesterday. Cloudy at the moment, patchy light rain or drizzle. Skies will brighten. Sunny spells for many into the afternoon. Just one or two isolated showers. Northern Ireland, day of sunshine and showers. Best of the weather, though, the further south and east you are. Some staying completely dry. For Scotland, we've got outbreaks of rain in the north at the moment. So that will head its way southwards, turning more showery as it goes. So some of you will stay dry, particularly across Dumfries and Galloway, the far west, and also across Shetland. Temperatures for Scotland, Northern Ireland, 10 to 14. England and Wales, 13 to 18. A chilly night tonight with frost in the north. A better day tomorrow with sunshine and only isolated showers.
So better weather on the way, but what about the roads, Orna?
Yes, still quite a bit of residual flooding after the heavy rainfall. The M60, it was an accident which caused queues. They're still there as well. So junction 14 at the East Lancs Road, backing up all the way on that anti-clockwise side to Simster Island at junction 18 and onto the westbound M62 to Haywood at 19. The M1's queuing on the southbound side, 29 Chesterfield to 28 at Alfreton. M4 queues, an accident which happened near Miskin in South Wales, is eastbound, one lane closed at junction 34. M25 queue still there on the western stretch near the M4 at junction 15, backing up to 13 Staines clockwise. A12, which is just near junction 28 of the M25 at Brentwood, two lanes are closed for an accident there, queuing traffic at the roundabout. M27 through the roadworks heavy as well, 8 at Busselton to 5 at Eastleigh. It's quite a stretch, taking you half an hour. And on the trains, you've got problems as well. So the West Coast main line, it's because of flooding earlier, but delays are still showing up. That's between Rugby and Milton Keynes. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Now, Katie is here with the sports. And, Katie, we need to talk about this man.
Rodri has gone down clutching the back of his right knee.
He's got his hands on his head at the moment. But how significant this could be. The signs aren't great.
No, signs aren't great and they're not looking great either. Manchester City midfielder Rodri has now flown to Barcelona to have more tests on the knee injury we heard there. That happened on Sunday in the draw with Arsenal. He was subbed off in the first half. Looks like he's going to be ruled out for an extended period. And that always hasn't always been a good thing for Manchester City. In his absence last September, they lost three games in a row. He was also a contender to win this year's Ballon d'Or with his exploits for them, for Spain at the Euros as well. And the boss, Pep Guardiola, admits losing him to the injury on Sunday did affect them on the pitch, but he hopes the team continue to respond well.
Affected the goal, and after that, by the way they play, of course, Rodri is the best midfield player, potential, I would love, Ballon d'Or winner, so he's an exceptional player, so of course it's important, what can I say? But a part of that is the team react and respond really well.
Yeah, and he'd spoken recently as well about the growing number of matches that players were having to be a part of, and he warned that he felt they were close to taking strike action in protest. And kind of on that theme, I guess you might say, City actually host Watford in the third round of the EFL Cup tonight. So that's just 2 days after their last game. Five Live will bring you commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa later. Sports Extra will bring you Walsall against Leicester. That's after the cricket finishes. More on that in just a moment. Everton, though, on the verge of new ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club. That's subject to approval. And also in football, Leeds United planning to expand their Elland Road capacity up to 53,000. And the ground has been sold out for every home match played in the last 6 years.
Now, England face Australia, Katie, in the third ODI this lunchtime. Is it a must win for England?
It most certainly is. So they trailed 2-0 in the five-match series. They have to win this one today to keep it alive. They were both convincing losses as well. And I mean, England certainly in a rebuilding phase of their white ball teams at the moment, relinquishing both their World Cup crowns recently. And I guess, I mean, you say obviously kick-starting a new era against the 50-over world champions, the Aussies, was never going to be easy. But let's hear from Adil Rashid, one of the few of the old guard left.
I think the 15 players picked in this are the best in the country. That's why they got picked. So we've got every base covered in terms of bowling, batting, keeping. Hopefully, like I said, we can, you know, show our character and let things unfold, and hopefully we can get a win.
So we've got TMS coverage on Sports Extra. That begins at 12:15. Elsewhere, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years yesterday. They beat Somerset by 15 runs. The match reduced to 20 overs because of bad weather. Rafael Nadal's been included in Spain's squad for the Davis Cup finals in Malaga. That's in November. Could potentially be his farewell event. The 22-time Grand Slam champion has suggested this is his last season. He hasn't played since the Paris Olympics either. The world number three, Mark Allen, says the playing conditions at Snooker's British Open are absolutely embarrassing. He beat Gary Wilson in Cheltenham, but in his own words, said the unplayable table should be burned. And a couple of NFL results to bring you as well from overnight. The Washington Commanders have beaten the Cincinnati Bengals 38-33, and the Buffalo Bills were 47-10 winners over the Jacksonville Jaguars. That is the latest from BBC Sport, and you can listen on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
It's that simple. Just get on with it. Do the right thing. Katie, thank you so much. It is 19 minutes to 9 now on 5 Live Breakfast. Rachel and Claire with you this week. Now, a former Harrods employee has told BBC News that a manager failed to investigate allegations she made of inappropriate behaviour by Mr. Al-Fayed. The BBC understands that manager still works at Harrods. The former employee, who we are calling Jessica, spoke to our correspondent, Ellie Price.
When I look back at it, I feel like she was acting as his pimp. It wasn't clear to me at that time. She was just a sort of a figure who I looked up to, in, you know, as one of the senior management. But now I reflect back on it, it's quite clear to see, you know, the actions that happened to put me in front of him came directly from her.
Well, it comes as a former Harrods chief executive has told the BBC he witnessed abhorrent behaviour from Mohamed Al-Fayed, but not sexual abuse. Let's speak now to former Victims Commissioner for England and Wales, Dame Vera Baird. Good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, it's just horrific, really, watching this documentary. And as often happens in these cases, when you air a story like this, more and more people come forward. Just your reaction to what you've heard so far about this case.
Yes, so clearly, you know, brave women confronted by somebody with royal connections, hugely rich, very, very influential and powerful, stepped forward when they were abused and went to the police, who are intended to assist them, as are the Crown Prosecution Service. And it just doesn't seem as if enough was done to, firstly, investigate. you know, you just have a sense that that probably somewhere there is a reaction that goes, oh my, it's all fired, let's be careful here. Whereas what you should be saying is, here is a complainant who's going to, you know, lose her job, who is confronting this rich man, who has huge courage. Why would she do this if there wasn't stuff in it? Let's have a look for evidence. And you just kind of doubt that that was ever the frame of mind. And that is the one that ought to have been present. Fine, people are coming out now. The police do have the opportunity. I mean, as I recall it from BBC's own, you know, excellent reporting, there were reports to the CPS in at least 2015, 2018, 21, and 23, and no action was taken, when there is now absolutely reams of evidence coming out. It is always possible, because it's so difficult for people to complain, particularly against a powerful man, but because, you know, all the kind of myths and stereotypes about women falsely complaining about rape come into play, I fear, even now, and certainly did then. But what the police can do, you know, it's frightening to have to take this step. They could have removed Al-Fayed's anonymity even before he was charged. Now, this is quite an unusual step to take, and I think it should only be taken with the leave of a judge. But if some people were coming forward and the police thought this wasn't enough, if they'd done that, the fact that women know that other women have had the courage encourages them, and they could have assembled the kind of case that we're now all seeing is greatly obvious. Yeah. Many years earlier.
Yeah, how unusual is that, though? Because just reading the detail of this, 2018, 2021, 2023, the CPS say, we reviewed files of evidence presented by the police, 2019 and 2015. To bring a prosecution, the CPS must be confident that there is a realistic prospect of conviction. In each instance, our prosecutors concluded this wasn't the case. I mean, do you think that is legitimate? Do you think that's watertight? Or do you think, as you're saying, well, maybe knowing what they knew, they could have found a way around this?
At the time, you know, let's be completely blunt, the CPS were just a dustbin of negativism about sexual abuse complaints. They had an especially high test, 10% higher than the ordinary test to prosecute before they would prosecute a sex offence trial. And it's in the middle of that culture that all of these complaints have fallen. So, I mean, the CPS are a little better now, and I hope on the way up, but that was definitely the case there. I mean, it really is a very worrying thing that with all of the information currently available, that, for instance, the lawyers are now beginning to get, they say that they've got probably about 100 women who've come forward. This is material that could have been obtained by the right operational decisions by the police and the support of the CPS. The CPS very regularly say, oh, the police didn't give us enough evidence, so we never even got a full file. But they were, as they accept, giving early legal advice, which means that, you know, frankly, they will have been involved with the police investigation at the very early stages and presumably can only have been given negative advice because they never got a full file to formally assess it. So
right.
I don't think you can slice between the police and the CPS and allocate the blame to one or the other. But clearly it's not been done well at all.
Yes. What is this temper? Just elucidate a bit on this higher proof, 10% higher burden of proof when it comes to these kind of cases. Why is that in place?
That's not, I hope, now in place. But there was, in fact, a very unusual step taken by the women's sector. The End Violence Against Women and Girls Coalition brought a high court action because that higher standard of for prosecution had been adopted, and a whistleblower made it very clear, and documentation came out that made it very clear that it was true, and they wanted to get that declared unlawful, but that didn't happen in the High Court. However, you know, ultimately the CPS have started to do better, but at that time it was, as I say, just a pit of negativism about prosecutions for sex offences. What urgently needs to be done is to tackle, obviously, what Harrods people knew about it. But I am very concerned
as to whether these women, you know, who have been shouldering the burden of being appallingly ravaged by this, you know, unspeakable individual, they've been shouldering that personally for many, many years now. Are Harrods paying for instance, a rape crisis organisation to come in, to invite them to talk, to look what they need? Do they need psychological help? Do they need psychiatric help? Do they need just, you know, the support of an organisation? I am very worried, you know, that although it looks as if, you know, there is now a big move afoot, is that being done? Are Harrods footing the bill as they should be? So the damage, you know, they got lots of profitability out of Al Fayed's period as the leader of that organisation. Are they spending some of it as they should be, making sure that these women can pull their lives together?
It's interesting you should say that, because we were talking to Gloria Allred, who is one of the chief prosecutors, one of the lawyers who's defending a lot of these women, taking their cases on. And on a couple of those issues, she said she was thinking, well, thank goodness Harrods are doing the right thing. They've said there's an ongoing internal review. It includes looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations, either directly or indirectly. And the current owners say they are utterly appalled by the allegations against Fayed and have been seeking to settle claims in the quickest way possible since new information came to light. Her point was, that's great, but actually her advice to those women was, fine, talk to Harrods, but actually what Harrods should be doing is saying, please go and talk to the police as well.
Absolutely. I have no knowledge of exactly how the new Harrods management have handled this. They appear to be settling cases, but I don't know, you know, how well. And this is the missing link for me. Yes, they should be encouraging people to talk to the police, because there may be culpable people still at Harrods who have helped this, what looks like a conspiracy to ensure that Fayed had any woman that he chose. And there is one story, isn't there, from the BBC, that he would wander around the store looking for women he fancied and then arrange to elevate them to his private office for fairly gross purposes. That can't have been a practice that was totally unknown. However, much of it's in the past, so there is a lot to be looked for properly. But what is not clear is that these women are getting all the help they need to put right the lives that will have been seriously disrupted by this individual's behaviour now, sometimes years and years ago. That's urgent.
Thank you so much for joining us. Former Victims Commissioner for England and Wales, Dame Vera Baird. It's 9:09.
Sean Farrington's here because he's been talking to the boss of Superdry on Wake Up to Money. And in particular, he's taken aim at the fast fashion retailer Shein being allowed to dodge tax, as he puts it. Sean, take us through this story.
Yeah, so Julian Dunkerton is the co-founder of Superdry, 20-odd years ago, chief executive of it now as well. It's a business that is a lot smaller than it once was. And Wake Up to Money, we were talking about a variety of things, about how Superdry, he's looking to get it to bounce back again. But he sort of came alight a little bit when we got onto the topic of rival retailers, and particularly Shein. Here's part of what he told me when I asked him about whether the business which people are mooting might be invited to list on the London Stock Exchange. Could be a £50 billion deal for Shein to list on the London Stock Exchange, where shares could be bought in it.
Take any fashion company that's based in the UK. They are paying import duties when they bring products in from China to resell them in the UK. They are paying VAT at the point of sale. And they're paying rates and income tax on their profits and their properties. So at what point do you say, if I don't have to pay all those, I've obviously got a commercial advantage? Is that the right thing to do as a society? I would suggest not, because ultimately it will undermine your long-term tax take in the UK.
So Julian Dunkerton sort of making the point there that he thinks that why would we sort of be bigging up a business that is taking away from the fashion industry that we have here in the UK. Yeah. Mm. So it's, you know, it's a hot topic, a hot debate, both for tax purposes of what Shein do, and also the question marks over sort of their supply chain and labour, the question marks over the labour market that they use in China as well, that they've had to answer. Shein saying that it's previously said its success isn't down to tax exemptions, is due to providing customers with affordable fashion.
Yeah, I wonder if other representatives in the fashion industry will be secretly pleased he stuck his neck out a bit on this one.
Yes, we've definitely heard Lord Wolfson, boss of Next. We've sort of seen his comments along these lines before, but it's not very often that there might be a long interview given where such a vocal part of it is dedicated to the issue. So there will definitely be, because we know there are plenty in the fashion industry who think the same, but there are plenty in the City of London who, while questioning some of the practices of Shein and all the companies that list on the London Stock Exchange, think that it's an opportunity to show that the UK is a good place to have a big business with transparent regulation, and that's how you can improve the practices in certain issues. But that's not necessarily about the tax issues, because if they are sending over cheap goods from China that are worth below £135, I think, they don't have to pay that import duty.
Quite legitimately, they can avoid it.
Quite legitimately, yes, exactly.
Thank you, Sean. Fascinating interview, that. It's 8:54.
Coming up this week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 8, 5 Live has commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham. Today there's ball-by-ball coverage of England against Australia in the third ODI on 5 Sports Extra.
And tonight at 8, Aston Villa travel to Wickham in the EFL Cup.
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you.
I can't believe we got this on twice
that
on our show.
Neither can I. I can forgive Celine this for her performance at the closing ceremony of the Olympics.
So good.
I'm going to rewatch that.
The closing ceremony, or was it the opening ceremony?
Which one was it?
I think she was the one shining moment of the opening ceremony.
That was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. All is forgiven, Celine. Not you need my forgiveness. The greatest love story on a ship since Titanic is what we're about to talk about now. Two people have found love after being stuck on that Villa V Odyssey. That's the big cruise liner, which was due to set sail from Belfast on May the 20th. It hasn't gone anywhere. Delayed due to repairs taking longer than expected. Earlier, we caught up with Angela and Jeanne, and they told us how it all started.
We're spending time on the ship and able to come there during the day, but had to go back to our hotels at night around Belfast. And we started walking together and created a very good friendship, and it kind of blossomed into a romance. We realized how compatible we were.
Oh, it's just such a lovely story. And you kind of bonded in a wider group, is that right, Angela? I mean, you were just thrown into this situation where you didn't know how long you were going to be stuck there.
That's correct. We pretty much anticipated setting sail right away when we got out here to Belfast. And it has turned out that 4 months later, we are still here hoping to set sail maybe in a week. And through that delay, though, some pretty magical things happened in my personal life.
I'll say. And when did you think, pardon the pun, but hello, sailor, Jeanne is, I think, potentially more than friend material?
I think you're probably right, actually, because we have now a new recent engagement. It's went quite a bit farther than friendship.
Oh, my goodness. Many congratulations.
Thank you.
Jeanne, when did you think she's the woman for me?
You know, it actually happened a lot faster than I expected. It's kind of like what you read in a book or see in the movies. I've been in love before, but nothing like this. It just, we really are soulmates.
Oh, stop. Did either of you two come on board the ship? Because this is where you're going to be on the ship for several years, possibly for the rest of your lives, right? Did either of you two come on board intending to meet someone else?
No, not at all. Actually, I was kind of looking. I definitely was looking for an adventure of a lifetime. I just didn't know that that would mean falling in love before I even set sail, actually.
Oh, listen, Jeanne, I want to probe further. When you say you've been in love before, but not like this, what is this like?
I don't know, without it sounding too sappy, but it's kind of all encompassing. We're just, we spend all our time together. We agree on everything. We're aligned on our goals. And, you know, as Angie said, coming onto a small ship and creating a relationship means you have to be really good friends, because there's no place to hide.
Yeah. I mean, this is quite a test, isn't it, really? And then you asked the indecent question about whether they'd, you know, doubled up in the old
combined cabins.
Yeah, interconnecting door.
All I was thinking was, you have one as your living area, walk-in wardrobe, whatever, blah, 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 blah. Mm. And then you've got your kind of restful area.
But then we discover the sisters there as well. I mean, can you? I feel sorry for the sister.
Third wheeling away.
Gooseberry.
Can you third wheel on a ferry?
What, forever. Forever and ever. That's it, isn't it? That's where they live now.
That is where they live. I don't know whether the sister stays there forever and ever or not. I'm not sure. Anyway,
not now.
Absolutely loved talking to Angela and Jan. And in fact, our editor outside was like, you and Claire are so into that. And yeah, I think you have to put your cynicism aside.
Yeah, as Celine has done her entire career. So thanks to everybody who's got in touch this morning about the homework issue as well. Should we just we leave with one or two?
Yeah, go on then.
On homework. One, good to see Five Live having another open session for teacher bashing. That's not what we're doing. I'm sorry you feel that way. Two, there's a lot of research supporting the use of knowledge retrieval in homework. And three, if homework is to end, then the current format of GCSE needs reducing.
And this one, which is a common theme, actually. One of the most important aims of education is to close the gap between advantage and disadvantaged children. Homework, even if it is effective, which is debatable, does the exact opposite. And that's from a teacher. Thank you for all of those messages this morning. So Nicky's coming up next. He's talking about antisocial behaviour. I'll be heading to Liverpool this afternoon, hoping to talk to the Prime Minister, putting some of your questions to him. You'll hear that, fingers crossed, tomorrow. Me and Claire back from 6 o'clock.
Yeah, see you then.
See you then.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nicky Campbell.
The voice of the UK.
Good morning. Welcome to The Nation's Phone-In. It's one for you, this. A case of welcome to our world. We want to know what's going on where you are. February 2023. The then Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said in a speech, antisocial behaviour is corroding local and social economic fabric in communities. Today, she's the Home Secretary, and she will say in her speech, we'll hear a bit of it later, rising streetcar crime is corroding the fabric of our communities. That word again, her chosen word, is it a well-chosen word? Is that what it's like? Does that resonate where you are? Or is this another day, another Home Secretary talking tough and chasing the headlines, the Daily Mail Holy Grail? Or is it a new Home Secretary getting tough and chasing down the yobs, sorting out local communities? And how are they going to do that? Making streets safer. How are they going to do that? Now, you know what we're talking about. All too well, perchance. Shoplifting, off-road bikes, harassment, intimidating behaviour, drug use, littering, street drinking, the big stuff and the small stuff. Except it's not the small stuff when it happens. Police are going to have new powers to scrap dirt and quad bikes. And a lot of rural antisocial behaviour as well. Let's hear about that too. There's going to be hit squads to target knife point robberies. They want mobile phone companies to put in a kill switch on new phones to stop them being stolen. You know, what's actually happening where you live? What does it look like where you are? How does it manifest itself? Antisocial behaviour. Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? How do we stop it? What would help fix it? What would make life better? We want to hear from you all over the country. It's a big one, this. It's what we do, and it's what you do best when you come on and tell us and give a picture of what's really going on. And politicians listen to the nation's phone-in. They'll be listening to you. Is antisocial behaviour corroding